supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Philadelphia City Council members grilled City Health and Human Services officials today about how they're handling the opioid crisis. As Joel Wolfram reports for WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, city officials said they're close to finalizing a plan to clear encampments of homeless drug users in the Kensington neighborhood.
There are still an estimated 200 people taking up residence under several bridges along Lehigh Avenue, and city officials say outreach workers will try to find a place for each of them. The plan would be based around a new shelter or respite where many could come inside and get referral for drug treatment and social services. Right now, there's only one shelter like this in Kensington, and it has just 40 beds. Homeless Services Director Liz Hirsch says the city is close to adding another site with 40 more, and we'll try to open a third later on.
Our goal is to open that second respite as soon as we can, and then the third in the general area, which would then give us 120 emergency beds.
Even that number isn't enough, but city officials say they expect some people will be able to return to their families and won't need a shelter bed. Councilwoman Maria Quinones-Sanchez, who represents Kensington, says the city isn't moving fast enough.
This encampment situation, if we don't tackle it now, it will become spring and summer. It will get normalized and it's going to be harder. People are more willing to come in the cold than they will be in the summer.
Council members also asked questions about what the city's Medicaid-funded treatment system is doing to help people suffering from addiction and which treatment options are most effective. But the questions took so much of the three-hour hearing that it didn't leave time for treatment providers and advocates who were lined up to testify. Casey O'Donnell is the CEO of Kensington's Impact Services and one of those who didn't have a chance to speak. He says the questioning could have gone more quickly had council members done their homework ahead of time.
Rather than spending a couple hours trying to get their heads around that piece.
For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Philadelphia is grappling with gentrification. As certain neighborhoods have become more attractive, real estate costs have risen, the vibe of some communities has been altered, and the change has produced winners and losers. WHYY is examining the issue from a number of different aspects in a new series called Gentrified, Stories from Rapidly Changing Philadelphia. I'm joined now by reporters Jim Saxa and Jake Blumgard from our Plan Philly team. They've dug through Philadelphia history to examine how and why neighborhoods gentrify. Jim, Jake, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Hey, Dave.
Thank you.
In the setup piece for the series, you note that gentrification is well underway in Philadelphia.
That's right. We look at one of the first neighborhoods to change like this here in the city, and that's the Society Hill neighborhood, which is now an upscale neighborhood between Independence Hall and South Street. But it used to look more like a slum.
Things really started to change back in the 60s.
And unlike a lot of the neighborhood change we see now, this was planned. Back then it was called urban renewal, and it was seen as a positive thing among city politicians.
Yeah, it was a way to fight back against white flight. The mass exodus to the suburbs that was a defining feature of just about every American city after World War II. Back then, cities were cramped, polluted, filled with crime. Most people who had the means to move to the burbs did. City living back then could be pretty rough.
Harsh but fair. And because of the redlining and other racist practices, it was much harder for blacks and Latinos to move to the suburbs.
So what changed?
Cities did, especially neighborhoods like Society Hill. We talked to a guy who's seen how Society Hill went from one of the poorest neighborhoods to one of the poshest. Harry Schwartz is 83.
We're talking about the 40s, and there were small merchants, a lot of vacant buildings.
Schwartz grew up near Hunting Park. Back then, that was a fairly well-off, mostly Jewish neighborhood. And Society Hill was a rundown, dirty neighborhood. He'd pass through when his mother would take him to his lessons at the Settlement Music School.
And in order to bribe me to be willing to go, she would give me lunch at the famous 4th Street Deli.
So what happened? What changed?
The city decided they wanted to make Society Hill a nice neighborhood for, well, the blue bloods and the wealthy. So they used condemnation to clear the slums. They shut down a huge food warehouse that attracted a lot of rats, and they rehabbed some of the historic townhomes.
And it worked. Mayor Richardson Dilworth moved his family and convinced a few other blue blood families to move with him. And soon they were joined by artists, and then after that, lawyers and doctors like Schwartz and his pediatrician wife. Schwartz worked at Deckert, one of the city's biggest law firms.
They were downtown. I could walk there. I could ride there on my bicycle. It was considered weird to ride a bicycle to work.
You know, that sounds pretty similar to what many millennials say today about why they live in the city.
And it is. You know, one of the big questions with gentrification is why people have been moving back to the inner city. Some people have always preferred city life, like the Schwartzes. And researchers think even more people prefer it today. But cities themselves have also changed.
That's exactly right. Schwartz moved to the neighborhood around the time that Congress expanded the Clean Air Act and passed the Clean Water Act. Before those laws, the rivers used to reek. The Schuylkill even caught on fire. And then, in the 1990s, crime started to fall really dramatically. And then the widespread use of the internet brought more jobs downtown.
All those variables, I'm sure, made city living more attractive.
Exactly. We asked Ken Steiff why cities like Philly are booming. Steiff's a professor of spatial analytics at the University of Pennsylvania.
The very simple reason for gentrification is that people love to live in cities. Cities are great places. They are vibrant places. They are places with great density of interesting people and things to do.
Let's note there's a downside to all of this. Gentrification boosts property values. That drives up rents and real estate taxes. And can't that force lower-income residents to have to move?
Yeah, so what we know now, what the research tells us, is that gentrification creates some winners and some losers among the incumbent residents, the people that are living there today. But Steiff says that we're not sure if that's a net positive or a net negative.
I don't think we've done a good job in understanding which moves are the result of that negative kind of displacement and which are people willfully selling their home and taking a profit.
So we know there are some losers, and the pain in some communities that are undergoing rapid change is real. Claudia Sherrod is the outgoing director of a social service nonprofit in South Philadelphia. She's upset with the pace of development in neighborhoods like Point Breeze.
The disrespect, the condescending expressions of developers who don't give a darn about this community have to be stopped. No one have no interest in how the character of the community was.
But we also know that there are some things that can be done to limit the people who lose out from gentrification.
So we could start building more affordable housing, or we could help residents fix up their homes in case they want to sell. We could also change the zoning in the city to allow people to build a lot more housing, which would, in theory, drive down the price over time.
Yeah, but there isn't a lot of policy coordination. Like, there's the Housing Authority, the Redevelopment Authority, the Land Bank, the Planning Commission, LNI, City Council, state government, federal government. It's a lot of people, but they, in theory, they could all be working together, but it just doesn't seem to be a priority for them.
Right. And if they can't figure out how to work together, then housing prices are just going to continue to rise. Here's Steiff again.
If you look at cities like New York and San Francisco that were in similar places 30 years ago, trying to find equity in those cities nowadays is almost a lost cause. Philadelphia still has some time.
So we really have to figure this out now, or more and more of the city could end up like Society Hill, which is really, really nice, but really, really expensive.
That's Plan Philly's Jim Saxa and Jake Bloomgard. Thanks for joining us, Jim and Jake.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
For more on gentrification in Philadelphia, check out WHYY.org. The series, Gentrified, Stories of Rapidly Changing Philadelphia, is a collaboration of Plan Philly, Keystone Crossroads, and WHYY News. You can join the conversation by telling us how gentrification has affected you or your neighborhood. Leave us a comment by calling 215-928-2408. That's 215-928-2408. In the heart of Pennsylvania coal country, another mine is shutting down. It's the latest in a long line of closures. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier went to the Four West Mine in Greene County on one of its last days producing coal.
Austin Turner was headed back home to West Virginia a few weeks ago from his job at the Four West Mine in Mount Morris, Pennsylvania. It was going to be one of his last shifts there, as the mine would be shutting down soon. At 19, he'd only been there 8 months, but he loved it.
It's a nice place to work, great group of guys, hard workers. I hate to see the place shut down, but it is what it is. Move on to another mine.
His face is covered in black coal dust after spending the day a few hundred feet below ground. He likes coal mining, he says, because it's not like other jobs.
Just the fact that it's something you most people never see. It's a little bit more of an adrenaline rush than most jobs. And my family did it, and I just kind of like carrying on the tradition a little bit.
And then there's the pay. Less than 2 years out of high school, he was making $28.60 an hour.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, I'm gonna miss it.
A few miles away, the Four West Belt Line rattles. It's part of a system of belt lines that carries coal 4.5 miles south to a power plant in West Virginia. It's pulling coal from a mine portal out up a hill about 1/4 mile, and you can see occasionally it'll dump big piles of coal over the hillside. Four West produced 1.6 million tons of coal last year, according to federal data, but the mine's productivity has waned in recent years. So the power plant it supplies will now buy coal from a different mine nearby. The mine's owners declined to comment for this story, but in published reports, they blamed poor geologic conditions for closing the mine. Art Sullivan is a coal mining consultant in Washington County. He said the Sewickley coal seam that Four West follows is not as productive as the Pittsburgh coal seam, where most coal mines in the region still work.
It's a thinner seam, and generally the geologic conditions are not as favorable.
Other mines use longwall mining machines, which are faster and more efficient than the machines that Four West uses. But Sullivan says there are also broader problems facing all coal mines. There are 5 new natural gas power plants planned for southwestern Pennsylvania in the next few years.
That level of electric generation typically will utilize 20 million tons of coal per year. So I see 20 million tons of coal being consumed by the electric utility in our region. It's going to disappear, and gas is going to replace it.
That'll leave fewer and fewer mines for people like Austin Turner to work in. A mile away from the Four West mine portal in the nearby town of Mount Morris, retired coal miner Alan Van Gilder said that's what worries him. 370 miners will lose their jobs at Four West when it closes.
It's a shame because there are going to be 300 and some people out of work, you know. And these coal mines are closing, and there's not very many coal mines that they could go to. I mean, they got families, you know. They have to have something to support them. But I don't know. It's a shame.
Several Four West miners didn't want to be interviewed on tape, but most said they would probably be able to find work at other mines, though they might have to take a pay cut or drive further away to do it. Four West will keep a crew on for several months until it closes the mine later this year. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
On Wednesday, students across the country will walk out of their schools to demand that lawmakers do more to protect the nation from gun violence. Many students in Philadelphia will take part, including 18-year-old Camel Jones, a senior at Science Leadership Academy, who was personally touched by gun violence.
My dad was shot. I was probably like 1 or 2. Some guy, like, he was in a car. Some guy shot him, took the car, and his best friend was actually murdered during this ordeal. And my dad survived, but he's paralyzed from the waist down. So I've never been able to see my dad walk. I feel like I've always cared about this issue because this is just something I've always had to be surrounded by. I'm the only child from my dad, and so I've always sort of had to deal with it because that's just how my life is, like how I've grown up. And I know that for the rest of my life, like, I'm always going to have to, like, take care of him. I remember Sandy Hook very clearly. So it was just like those innocent lives who they... they couldn't help themselves. Like, they were such little kids, they can't help themselves. And so that sort of, like, broke my heart, and, like, to see helpless people, lives being taken, that is what really, like, struck me. The Orlando shooting, and that just, like, breaks your heart. Like, 50 people shot for going out and having fun. Like, all those people that happened in Vegas, those people were shot when they were just having fun. And I think the Parkland shooting, like, these students, they're going to change the world. Our age group and our generation, that's so doubted based on, like, the technologies that we have, that we're too busy on Twitter, we're too busy on Instagram. But we're using those platforms to speak out, and we're not afraid to speak out. And I think people are scared of that. I definitely think we should have stricter gun laws. I know we can't take away all guns from people. Like, that's just something that we can't do. But I just don't think that assault rifles should be sold. I don't think I should be able to own a gun. I'm 18 years old. There's no reason for me to own a gun. There's no reason for anyone really to own a gun other than hunting. I do think it's a tipping point. Well, at least I'm hopeful that it is. I think our generation is tired of it, and I think we've seen it all of our lives, but we're actually doing something about it. They tell us to shut up, but we still keep talking. We're powerful. We've already seen all these companies drop the NRA, and I think our generation, like, we're moving, and I think we just have, like, such a great atmosphere of people that are willing to work, and we're all willing to work. We're all willing to make a difference.
Science Leadership Academy senior Kamal Jones. Our Milky Way galaxy's close neighbor appears to be on a diet. Helping us to count cosmic calories is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, what's going on in Andromeda?
The Andromeda Galaxy, like ours, is a gigantic collection of hundreds of billions of stars. It's about 2.5 million light years away from us, but when we try to measure its weight, it was determined that Andromeda was about 3 or 4 times bigger than our galaxy.
Bigger, again, by weight, a thumb on the scale, or dimension, size?
Well, at first it was thought that it was about the same size, but just had a lot more stuff. Lots more stars, lots more gas, lots more mass. But more recent analysis shows us something quite different. What we see of the galaxy accounts for only 10% of its mass. So now the question is, if it doesn't have anywhere near as many stars, how does it weigh so much? We end up with the answer that seems to be a really great catch-all term for a lot of things, and that is, it looks like dark matter is a major component of this galaxy, much more so than we ever thought before.
That's a real catch-all if it accounts for 90% of the stuff.
Yeah, it seems like it's most of the galaxy. But then when you compare that with the other findings about dark matter and dark energy around the universe, maybe it lines up pretty nicely, because 96% of all the stuff in the universe is dark matter and dark energy. Only 4% is the actual real matter that we see, the real material stuff.
Now, let's note that at 2.5 million light years away, it's pretty distant, yet it's coming closer and closer to our Milky Way.
One of the most interesting aspects of the relationship between the two is that we are on a collision course. Yes, our gigantic galaxy with its hundreds of billions of stars and our neighbor galaxy at some point in the future are going to ram into each other. And this is not an unusual thing to happen for galaxies. There are plenty of examples of galaxies merging all throughout the universe.
Will it be Milky Dromeda or An Wei?
I like the Milky Dromeda part, but we won't find out for another little bit, because it looks like this probably won't take place for at least 5 billion years, in which time our own sun will begin to grow and change in such a way that the Earth may no longer be here in this portion of the solar system anyway.
Never mind summer. It's still chilly, but when's spring?
Well, not too far away, actually. Just about 8 days away. But we're getting a good taste of spring right now, because if you're listening to this program on time, well, that's because you adjusted your clock yesterday, moving your clock ahead 1 hour. We're gaining about 2 minutes and 40 seconds of sunlight every day, and that's on both ends of the day. So you'll notice that sunset comes at 7 p.m. But in the morning, sunrises are coming earlier as well. Right now, sunrise is at about 7:15 in the morning. But by the end of the month, sunrises will be coming a half hour earlier at about 6:45. That, of course, will continue as we move on towards summer.
In our time left, anniversaries of note this week. 1879 is a year of note.
The year when Albert Einstein was born. Einstein, of course, is very well known for his general theory of relativity, the special theory of relativity, and so many other things, particularly his iconic matter-to-energy equation, E equals mc squared.
The c squared refers, I believe, to the speed of light?
It does. It's really very simple. If you take any matter and accelerate it to the speed of light, you're going to convert it out to energy. So this is the reason why we have to understand that if we wanted to reach the speed of light, all of our matter would have to be converted to energy in order to get us to that point. So we no longer become the payload, but become the fuel that drives the spacecraft to that incredible speed. But who knows what happens when we get there?
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.